Good morning, everyone. And welcome to the Board of Public Works. Today is September 22nd, 2010. And we have an agenda before us today on this beautiful day. I wanted to say a word about the most recent numbers came out on the economy and about the most recent numbers for August showing a net job loss rather than a net job gain. While there will be occasional setbacks, the fact also remains that for this January through August has been the best period of new job creation in Maryland that we've seen since the year 2000. So, and we have a rate of job creation that is twice the national rate of job creation. So we want to see a net positive every month. That won't always happen. But over the long term, there are very few states, only four of them, that have held on to their private job base better than we have. And I don't believe that there is any state better positioned to come out of this recession and make the decades ahead very positive decades for job growth and job creation than Maryland is because of our hard work in protecting the priorities that make for an innovation economy. We also have launched a new thing called the Maryland Workforce Exchange, which is a single portal that combines job openings from all over the state. The person can search by industry sector as well. And we know there's a lot of moms and dads that have been searching for jobs for weeks and months here, and you know, none of us can give up. We have to all keep moving forward, and there are better days coming. So let me ask if the treasurer, the comptroller, have any words as we open this meeting.
I do not, except to say good morning, and I think Governor, that you're right, and I actually have been talking to some treasurers and bond rating folk and other investors from around the country. There's no doubt that things, while they are better, and you can see that in our revenue estimates, no question about that, things are still very difficult across this nation. And I, for one, am very thankful that we've made the investments in education and the community that we had, even though it meant sacrificing other things that were terribly important. Because, as you know, I believe that education, elementary, secondary, higher education, workforce training, really is the basis for our success in the future. And hope we continue to stick to those priorities.
Mr. Comptroller.
Thank you, Governor. I just wanted to remind everybody, tonight is the official start of fall. I want to wish everyone a happy and safe fall season. And after the harsh winter and the scorching summer that we've had, I hope that we get a break in the term, in weather terms. I know one group of Marylanders who might actually be wishing for some big snowfalls are the hundreds of thousands of students who are now back in our wonderful Maryland schools. They may be daydreaming still a little bit about summer, but in many cases they returned to sparkling, clean, newly renovated schools, or frankly, completely new buildings. And here on the board, I've been proud to support the governor and the General Assembly and the treasurer, the historic investment by Maryland in school construction over the past few years. I've visited countless schools to inspect and review these projects. As we move forward, I want to make it a priority to recognize and highlight those schools that are doing an outstanding job of maintaining their buildings and thus helping us save taxpayers' dollars. Every year, we honor the few schools that have been randomly inspected and rated superior by Dr. Lever and our state's Interagency Committee for Public School Construction. In the past weeks, I've visited two of these schools, Davidsonville Elementary here in Anne Arundel County and Charlestown Elementary in Cecil County. Two great schools. I had wonderful visits. I really thank Dr. Lever and the IAC for doing a tremendous job, and their inspection program is a great asset to the state. But while it's fitting and important that we bring these superior schools here to the board for acclamation, as we've done, I also want to reward those schools whose ratings have progressed from inadequate to adequate or from adequate to very good. I believe, that we're entering an era, mini era of austerity, where we are going to be forced to do more with less. And those school systems that put a priority on maintaining their current buildings and those schools that are finding innovative ways to keep their buildings healthy, safe, and clean deserve to be recognized. I've seen so many examples where effective maintenance, including simple and affordable investments like a fresh coat of paint, new carpeting, good power washing. Did one myself up at a school in Baltimore. It's amazing how that makes a difference. In addition to providing communities with a renewed sense of pride, research has confirmed the obvious and positive impact that clean, attractive, and comfortable facilities have on student performance. It's in that spirit that I've established a special recognition, the Silver Hammer Award, for schools that have demonstrated a commitment to fiscal responsibility through superior school maintenance. Recipients of the Silver Hammer Award will be based upon the recommendations of and input from each of the local education associations and in consultation with the IAC staff. So this fall, I look forward to hearing from school districts, traveling to those schools, and reporting back to the board on the best practices and innovative methods of building maintenance that are being used to help save taxpayers' dollars. And I'll do my best to see that these schools continue to be recognized and appreciated for their efforts. Governor, thank you for the time, the focus, and the investments that you have made in our children and their public schools.
Thank you, Mr. Comptroller. Let's go to Secretary's agenda. Ms. McDonald.
Good morning, Governor. We have a presentation from the University of Maryland College Park. We could do the university system agenda, or we can go straight to the Secretary's agenda. Would you like to hear from Dr. Wiley or go straight to the Secretary's agenda?
We can do the presentation.
Okay. So
remind me what we had asked.
All right. Dr. Ann Wiley is here, Vice President at University of Maryland College Park.
The sustainability. Maryland was one of 19 that was selected, universities across the country that was selected because you achieved the highest possible score on sustainable campus, right?
It was 18 and by the Princeton Review, and we actually have no idea what criteria they use. But,
but what is it that you do?
But I'd like very much to give you a quick overview.
Thanks for coming.
I'd like very much to give you an overview very quickly of the many things that go on at the University of Maryland that with a focus on sustainability, and I think it's probably the sum total of these that the Princeton Review is reflecting in their ranking.
Yeah, it was my understanding when I read the press release that the ranking was that there were 19 that achieved the highest possible score, and we were one of them.
Yes, we were, and there are more than 700 that were actually considered. So
right.
We consider that to be an extreme.
In other words, that we weren't 19th, we were tied for first with
the right.
Others.
That's right. That's exactly right. Thank you.
That's what I read.
I think that's what we put out. the sustainability of the University of Maryland is really a part of our culture. And I think it began more than 10 years ago with our facilities master plan, which at that time had sustainability and environmental stewardship as a major theme. And over the last 10 years, we really have taken up this agenda and put it in everything that we do. We have received awards in addition to the Princeton Review that you see up here. Every time there is a ranking of sustainability, the University of Maryland is mentioned among the top. Rankings are a funny thing. Some rankings consider one quality, others something else. The University of Maryland was recently ranked 8th in the nation by the Wall Street Journal for the quality of our graduates in the corporate recruiting world, and we're very proud of that. That was done by a survey of recruiters. The U.S. News and World Report uses a set of data, a lot of which is financial, in which we rank 18th among national universities.
And could I just interrupt to harken back to what I said at the beginning of this meeting? I think that the investment in education is not only paying off in these great rankings, but most importantly, paying off in the great graduates and the great workforce we're going to have, as well as making us a model in so many ways. I just
and therefore the better economy
yeah.
that we have.
And I saw you sitting there, Madam Vice President, and I didn't thank you, and I
thank you very much. We appreciate it. So the Princeton Review America's Greenest Campus contest, we actually won that nationally on the basis of the efforts of our students, faculty, and staff who assessed personally online their carbon footprint and made a commitment to decrease it. So there are all different ways that sustainability and rankings work. But I think whenever there is one, the University of Maryland is ranked high, and it really reflects that we are nationally recognized for sustainability efforts. The UM sustainability strategy really goes across everything that we do. We focus on infrastructure and operations. We promote sustainable behaviors. We enhance sustainability through education and research. We have a university sustainability council that is designed to advise the president on policy. And the Office of Sustainability has been in existence 3 or 4 years. And I'm joined today by Scott Lupin, who is the director of the Office of Sustainability. So if you have any questions at the end of this brief presentation, I'm sure he could help us. The Student Sustainability Fund is actually a fee that 91% of the undergraduates voted in favor of imposing on themselves 3 years ago. They voted in a fee, ultimately to be $12. Last year it was $4, this year it's $6, next year it'll be $8, and so forth. And that fee is administered by a student committee with recommendations to the Sustainability Council. So this commitment to sustainability goes everywhere. We have a environmental friendly procurement policy, which Jim Sterling helped develop. So we're looking in the purchase of all of our products in their environmental impact. The University of Maryland was one of the first 100 signatories to the American College and University President's Climate Commitment, which commits to reducing our carbon footprint to zero by 2050. And we established we set up a climate action plan, which was developed by a committee that worked broadly for more than a year, which laid out strategies to enable us to reach that goal. We actually have been remarkably successful. Since 2005, our carbon footprint has been has decreased by more than 10%. I have to be quite honest and tell you that there's a little tiny bit of that, maybe a percent or two, that has to do with better data. But the rest of it is really quite genuine. We are actually decreasing our carbon footprint.
Well, and until recently, we never bothered to actually have good data on any of these, whether in the university system or in state government. That's a new development over these last 4 years.
Yes, that's correct. Next slide. Renewable energy, of course, we look to help solve some of this reduction in our carbon footprint. We have placed hot water panels on the North Campus dining hall, which provides about a third of our hot water needs for that dining hall. With that student sustainability fee last year, we purchased renewable energy credits. That fee will go in the future toward energy efficient projects, but for the first year, the students actually wanted to do something with it right away. So that was about almost $100,000 toward renewable energy credits. The USM worked closely with the state on the Clean Horizons project. This was led by our very able energy manager, Joan Kowal, and we have 3 contracts. We would like to have 20% of our energy produced by renewable sources. These contracts will give us about 15%, so we're very pleased to have a source of purchased energy for the next 20 years with this high renewable component. We recently received from the Maryland Energy Administration Project Sunburst, $630,000 to put solar energy on Comcast. So we're trying to find every source of funds we can to advance our sustainability.
Awarded by the Maryland Energy Administration.
Yes. The DOA grant. Green buildings. We're very proud of our green building and our LEED certification. Silver is our standard. We just opened Knight Hall with that received LEED Gold certification. Our South Campus Commons Building 7, our residence hall, opened in January with LEED Gold certification. We have other projects, Oakland Hall, the Physical Sciences Complex, which we hope at least the sorority house renovations, at least the majority of these will be LEED Gold. You don't know until you get down to the very end, but we will certainly do that. We have more than 19 LEED certified professionals on our staff, so we begin thinking about a sustainable building from the day that we begin the design, and that's really the way that you can accomplish this high level of certification. You have to start from the very, very beginning. Stormwater management is another area where we have put a great deal of effort. We have green roof on Cumberland Hall. We also have one on the Student Union, green roof on Denton Dining Hall, and we're planning one on our new shuttle bus facility. We have two cisterns operating, one on Knight Hall and one in the center of Washington Quad, and we utilize the water that we collect from those cisterns to water the plants in the immediate area. Recycling. We are introducing a program called Can the Can, and we no longer have garbage cans in three of our buildings, and we hope to expand that to the campus. We have a recycling bin. In my office, I have a recycling bin, and this is my garbage can, and I keep this on my desk, actually, and I am responsible for emptying it myself, so we don't have any housekeeping staff emptying garbage. Their efforts are entirely on removing our recycling. In the main administration building, we introduced this. I had to subject my associates to this. Our recycling rate went from 49% to 77% in just 2 months. So this is a really important step in.
What do you put in that?
I put in, well, it's empty now, but I had, when I opened it to, earlier to bring, it had an apple core and some candy wrappers. So I put in the things that will not recycle that I generate in my office.
You don't have compost.
Well, it's a little hard in my office.
It's a little hard in your office.
Well,
I
have one apple core and three candy wrappers, so
we've got to separate out the candy wrappers.
But we do compost. That's a very big effort for us on our waste generated by our dining halls and in special events. So we have a very big composting effort. Overall, recycling on the campus has increased to 57%, and we really hope to get this above 80 as we expand the can across the university. Transportation, our shuttle bus operation is expanding its use tremendously. We have more than 2.5 million individual rides per year, and it's increasing dramatically. Our number of parking permits on the campus has been going down. So we're doing everything we can to enhance public transportation and design routes that serve the majority of our students. We've done a lot of things to try to bring students closer to the campus also to reduce the commuting distance of our students. Well, that's kind of a quick overview. There is a document that you have, which you didn't put to, integrating sustainability across the curriculum. This is a very important effort. We have a lot of majors that focus on sustainability themselves, but we want to bring sustainability in other areas throughout the curriculum. And so for the last 2 years, we've held workshops, and we bring faculty in, and we try to get them to show them ways that they can use sustainability in whatever course they teach. And so we've had 56 courses so far revised to include sustainability. And the last slide. We have a website, and I urge anyone that would like to know more about what we do to go on our website, and there's some very, very good and comprehensive information. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Could I just hear from your director? Is he...
Come on, Scott.
Excellent. Do you have anything to add?
Well, it has been a process of several years, as I mentioned.
Tell us your name for the record again.
Oh, sorry. Scott Lupin.
And Scott, spell your last name.
L-U-P-I-N.
And your title is?
I'm the director of the Office of Sustainability.
Witness
for the University of Maryland. College Park. Really, I've been at the university for 13 years, and sustainability has been an evolving part of our culture, and it continues to be so. The university spent great effort when I first began to work on environmental regulatory programs and made a conscious decision to move beyond compliance into really environmental performance. And it has really infiltrated much of what we do, from facility design to our current deliberations about our facilities master plan to how we structure the curriculum. There's talk about a minor in sustainability. And it's not just the University of Maryland. It's really college universities across the country are very engaged in this topic. And in fact, I attended on Monday a sustainability education summit here in Washington. And some of the leading folks talking about this issue were talking about the need to ensure that our students coming out of K through 12 and out of our universities are in fact eco-literate, and how to integrate this issue into our curriculum, into the student learning experience. And so for many, they think this is a really pressing issue for the up-and-coming generations. So more and more, it's become part of the university's culture. So I'm very pleased to be a part of it.
Good stuff. Can I ask you, we've got to get you into the collaborations that are going on with Department of Natural Resources and the military bases in our state, because your campus, their campus, and they're very similar. And are you in that loop yet?
Well, I did speak with somebody at DNR yesterday, and we're going to begin to talk about how to...
Because they knew I'd ask you when you came in here today.
We've been playing phone tag for 2 weeks, and we finally connected with each other, and we're going to we'll talk about how I can provide assistance, how the university can provide assistance to that effort. So we're going to begin to decide how to work the university into those discussions.
And your game plan here, I mean, very simple dashboard showing what you're achieving, what you're not achieving, what you're halfway to achieving. That's great. And each of those military bases, I think, would find this a useful template for themselves. One of the things that was not touched on was the potable water and reducing water consumption, hugely important for any campus with that many human beings packed into it. What have you done that was the most cost-effective? I saw pictures of replacing the low-flow toilet fixtures. Was that an expensive thing? Is that ongoing?
It is expensive, but it's been going on for several years in terms of changing out china in restrooms and low-flow spigots and shower heads. That's really the most effective thing we've done so far. But there's a lot to be done in terms of water capture, gray water reuse, and so forth that we have not ventured into in a significant way, but I think we will as we delve into this next master plan, facilities master plan. There's going to be some discussion about how to capture more water and reuse it beneficially. So it's an area that has a lot of room for improvement, but we have seen a reduction of about 14% in our water consumption in the last 2 years. So, again, it takes time. It does cost money to change out restroom fixtures and so forth, but there's a lot we can do, I think, down the road to better use stormwater that is otherwise flowing into our streams and to reduce the environmental impact of that and to beneficially use the water and reduce our potable water consumption along the way.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. Keep going. And as if our lives depend on it. You know?
It's an important issue.
It's the faster you move, the more the rest of the country will move.
I'd like to apologize. I see that you, in fact, are composting more than 100 tons a year,
right,
which is a whole lot of compost.
I see our dying curve because we have a block and from one source.
Where do you take it to compost it?
Going to a facility in Cecil County called Recycled Green, which is the only commercial facility I'm aware of in Maryland.
For composting.
Right.
We this year have looked at who did several experiments trying to try other methods of treating organic waste. We had two pilots operating, one of which turned organic waste into gray water, and the other one made it really into compost itself. Right at the scene, that we could, something that we could use to press out the water. And both of them were failures, but we are continuing to attempt to try because we have to transport it so far. We'd like a better solution.
Do you coordinate with these other campuses? Do you all share best practices? These other 19 that were, other 18 that were number one?
We do. Yes, we have a couple of different conferences, one hosted by the University of Maryland, Smart and Sustainable Campuses Conference, a national conference of all sorts of folks from college and universities that get together, talk about issues related to sustainability, best practices, case studies, and our fifth conference will be this coming March on the College Park campus. So there are two or three major conferences, national conferences held every year amongst college and university people, both from facilities, sustainability directors, people from administration, faculty, students, that get together and talk about these issues. So we do share stories, and we have a really broad network. So.
Anybody come from overseas, like Sweden?
We do get some international attendees.
They're pretty clever. They seem like they're about 20 years ahead of us on this stuff, too.
I'd like to thank very much the leadership of the state, because it makes it possible for us to be successful. We wouldn't be there if we didn't have your support.
Well, this was great. Thank you all very, very much. Keep going. All right, let's go to the Secretary's agenda.
Okay, good morning, Dave Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. We have 10 items on the Secretary's agenda. We have 3 reports of emergency procurement, and we're prepared to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions on the Secretary's agenda? At the first hearing, none. Controlling moves approval, seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. All opposed, nay. The ayes have it. We move now to program open space, and we have the Mayor of Crisfield, P.J. Purnell, I understand, is with us because there is a hiker-biker trail on our agenda. And what page would Mayor Purnell's item be on?
Item 7A.
Item 7A. Mr. Mayor, how are you?
Good.
Good to see you. How is Crisfield?
Crisfield's good. Governor, Madam Treasurer, Controller, on behalf of the City of Crisfield, I come before you today asking and extending my appreciation and thanks for your pending decision on providing us with $136,000, I think it is, to complete phase 4 of a public park. We in the community of Crisfield probably have the highest unemployment both in Crisfield and in Somerset County in the state of Maryland, and this recreational opportunity is very vital to our future. I heard earlier that you were talking about jobs, and one of the other points I wanted to make under leadership of the governor, Department of Business and Economic Development, this year we got a grant to help the Sherwood-Williams Company retool their plant, and it increased our employment by 10%. 100 jobs for a town the size of Crisfield that has less than 1,000 jobs. So you kind of see state government all working together, and it's worked out extremely well.
And thank you for your time and taking me through that plant and being able to meet those moms and dads that are working there.
One last thing, I'd like to have the city councilman that I brought with me, who's kind of my program manager, would you say, project manager for this park. I'd like to have him have an opportunity to say a few words and to extend his gratitude to the Department of Natural Resources.
Governor, Treasurer, Comptroller, as we've moved forward with what was originally 32 acres of marsh and upland area that could have, because of its critical areas exemption, been used to have been filled in with bricks and mortar and destroyed another scenic vista of the park. We set aside this area with program open space monies with the behest of a, eventually, hopefully, a 7-phase application of infrastructure building and all. By doing this, we will preserve open space, not necessarily for ball fields, but for vistas, walking trails, environmental stations and things that are contingent upon what is so important to all of us, and that is the preservation of the Chesapeake Bay. With that, I would like to say there's a small thing that is an error in the application process that I did not review. It says that the walking trail will have the pervious surface that will be utilizing crushed oyster shells, and that was never intended to be so. We're using sea clam crushed shells, not something that would otherwise be put back over perceived there. So, once again, always cognizant. Our city inspector, who is part of the park advisory board, we're working very hard in the innovation of using solar and wind energy for facilities used there. And it is with your funding through the good auspices of DNR, Program Open Space, CHIP.
Thank you, CHIP.
All of those good things. We just like to thank you all for your consideration. It's always great to work with you. I would like to say one other thing. We've all, as a councilman in Crisfield, we all know about highway user funds and how municipalities have fought on that. In the presence of Delegate Conway the other day, I went on public record of saying, if I have to choose between highways and education, I know where I want my emphasis to be. So although I may feel like I need an apology to my constituents for the limited amount of work that we can do on the streets, and we have done some tremendous work on our streets, even in the meantime, the educational focus of this administration and this pushes us in the right direction for the future, and I applaud you. We have to make decisions in tough times, and I think we've made the right decision. I applaud you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilman.
Mr.
Comptroller?
Mayor Pinnell, I just want to thank you. Whenever I see you, I think of two things. One is one of my great predecessors, Governor Taws, who, as you know, is the only Marylander in history to occupy at different times all three seats of the Board of Public Works.
Well, Mr. Comptroller, at 70 years old, I can guarantee you I have no dream of doing that.
But I also think, thank you, I also love the fact that he, I think, said that he liked being comptroller the best, but I also want to just compliment you on the crap feast. It's a wonderful day down at Taws and Crisfield, and everyone that came down this summer, it was a little bit hot, but it was a tremendous gathering of talent and citizens and oysters, everything else. So it was a wonderful day, and I'd love to someday see our board come down there and have a meeting on the day that you're having your great gathering, because
we could arrange that and even serve crafts.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Can I just, Mayor, ask one question? I echo everything that has been said and think that the emphasis on sustainability on the pervious surface is terrific. I noticed it's traversing an abandoned railroad deck. Is there any chance of getting any trails money?
It's been abandoned a long time. It really has. It's probably pushing 25 years.
That is part of our research and utilizing it.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Any other items on program open space we want to look at? Hearing none, Comptroller moves approval, seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. We now move on to the Department of Budget Management.
Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, good morning. There are 10 items on the Department of Budget and Management's agenda for today, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
I want to commend you on number one, which I think, in fact, is your agency, the online job postings, which look like it's not only a great thing to go online to fill those few jobs that you're allowing us to fill, but to do it in a cost-effective way.
It's been very successful. We've had 32 agencies to post over almost 300 jobs. Your office has used it. The comptrollers use it. I certainly use it. It's been great.
And the fact that you can do it at a really significant savings.
Thank you.
Good. Great.
Anything else?
Yes.
Budget Mr. Comptroller.
Thank you, Governor. Item 10S. This is
Item 10F is a contract for the operation and the management of the Charlotte Hall Veterans Home. And to speak on that item, we have Sharon Matisse, who's the director of the Veterans Home Program.
Excellent. I see the total amount is, with the options, is $190 million.
For the five-year term.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this contract received a lot of scrutiny,
frankly,
from this board. I think it was the subject of a bid protest that the State Board of Contract Appeals finally resolved. I don't want to go over the whole history, but I just have a couple of questions for you. How would you characterize HMR's management of the Charlotte Hall facility?
They've been at Charlotte Hall. Well, first of all, I'm Sharon Mattia. Good morning, Comptroller.
Good.
Governor O'Malley and Madam Treasurer. Charlotte Hall Veterans Home has been managed by HMR for the last 6 years, and its census has increased by 140 residents. They have made strides with the VA in partnership with the Maryland Department of Veterans Affairs in implementing the CPRS, which is a computerized patient record system. Their senior management has over 10 years of experience with veterans homes and assisted living, whereas the other offeror did not have that experience. So we're very pleased with the management, with their senior staff, and how they treat the employees at Charlotte Hall.
Well, that's crucial because they're so important to us.
The veterans are very important to us.
And so you're convinced that they're doing a good job?
Absolutely.
And the fact that the competitor bidder was $900,000 less a year, I think.
About 3%.
3%. Is that something that was looked at by you as far as making sure that the price disparity was...
For the services that we get, yes, sir.
And the what you or the VA looked at, technically, what exactly was that that outweighed the price disparity?
Well, the technical ranking was weighted heavier than the price rating, and the evaluation committee has had criteria as far as the contract, and HMR outweighed the technical ranking. We ranked them 1 and 2. So they were 1, the second offer was 2. And basically it was based on experience. Their MBE participation was 21.1%, and our contract only asked for 20%. So they had more kudos for that. And we asked in the RFP that the offeror would propose a report card. And in that report card, they were to, list their performance guarantees and liquidated damages, and they did a wonderful job. Their technical proposal was outstanding.
Excellent. And do you make the decision, or is it to the federal government?
No, not the federal government, the state of Maryland.
State of Maryland. Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Governor.
Thank you. Okay, Madam Treasurer, Master Controller, anything else on the Department of Budget Management agenda?
Move approval.
Seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed, nay. The ayes have it. We move on now to the University System of Maryland.
I'm Jim Sterling for the University System. We have 15 items on today's agenda. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions, University System of Maryland agenda items? Hearing none, Treasurer moves approval, seconded by the Comptroller. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. We move on now to the Department of Information Technology.
Good work.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. L.A. Schlanger, Department of Information Technology. This morning we have 4 items on our agenda, and I would be happy to answer any questions at this time.
Thank you. Okay. Treasurer moves approval, seconded by the Comptroller. All in favor, signal by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. The ayes have it. We move on now to the Department of Transportation.
Good morning, Governor, Mr. Comptroller, Madam Treasurer. For the record, I'm Harold Bartlett, Deputy Secretary of MDOT, and MDOT today is presenting 25 items. Item 27AE has been added as a supplemental item. Items 18 and 19 have been previously withdrawn, and for the record, items 17, 20, and 27AE have been previously submitted as revised items, and we're prepared to answer any questions you might have.
I had a question, but I think it probably was of Elliot, and I missed my chance. It was the 511 number issue, and I thought it was transportation, but I see it was.
Mr. Schlanger, would you please return to the podium?
Just talk about this. I mean, this is a very, very significant step forward for Maryland.
Let me just clarify, this is item one on the DOIT agenda, item one on
I was sitting here flipping through looking for it in transportation.
Recalling for informational purposes.
Yeah.
On that. Item number one is a contract to design, build, and operate, host, and maintain a traveler's information system, 511. We all know about 911 and 311 and 411. Well, now we're going to have a 511. And I have my colleagues from, here they are, from MDOT, who would be happy to give you detail on that project.
Is this as significant a step forward as it looks for us? Travelers.
Just for the record, Bob Gage, State Highway Administration. Good morning. With me, I have Glenn McLaughlin, who is the Deputy Director, Office of Chart, and Rick Dye, who is our Chart System Administrator, and they're the technical experts behind this project, and they can take us through the various things that we're going to get out of this project.
And describe for me what it is. Describe it. If you were appearing before a community meeting of the citizens for whom we all work, what would you tell them we're doing here, and why is it going to impact their life?
Good morning, Governor, Treasurer, Comptroller. Again, I'm Glenn McLaughlin, the Deputy Director with the Office of Chart and ITS Development. The 511 program is an opportunity for the state to take information that we currently have that we use to manage roadways and transit on a daily basis and be able to deliver it to the public in a more efficient manner that they can access more easily than we currently do. And it's part of a national program, which includes, which has been going on for about 10 years. The USDOT and the Federal Communications Commission identified 511 as an abbreviated dialing code. People can access the information through a phone system, but it will also include a website. We're going to include social media, Facebook and Twitter, in order to be able to provide the information that way.
I wonder if you can loop it into GPS.
Well, there's certainly a lot of companies that are working on providing information through GPS. That isn't part of what we're going to be doing.
So the notion of this is that if one is traveling someplace, one calls 511 to find out what's on the road ahead?
Well, hopefully they'll use it before they are driving because it can lead to a distraction. There are opportunities within the website and the service to inform people, you know, of safe driving habits, to not, you know, be using it. In case they do decide to call it with a hands-free system, we're going to try to tailor it so that the system will identify them based on their number. And we'll be able to tailor. They can just say, I want my morning commute, and it'll automatically give them the information. So they can do it hands-free.
So is this all automated?
Yeah, it recognizes their voice, and it takes information from the systems we currently have and then provides it to them.
So we'll know to avoid the construction zones and the...
Absolutely.
That's great. I would have gotten to Baltimore much faster yesterday.
So we could call and say we're going to Silver Spring from Annapolis. And there's a prompt identified by your voice.
Yeah, it's menu driven. So it'd be similar to using a unless that you've tailored it for your own purposes in advance, it would be a menu driven system. So a person coming in for the first time would have to go through selection process. But again, it would be similar to, you know, calling in at a bank or whatever and getting information that way. Of course, the voice recognition technology keeps getting better and better, so you wouldn't hopefully have the experience of, you know, having to repeat yourself.
Mm-hmm. I told you. The source of funds is?
Well, it's federally funded.
Federally funded. And the federal government's encouraging us to do this.
Absolutely.
Is there any state that's already done it?
We'll be 20 or 30 states have done it already.
Well, okay, so this is a matter of us getting with the curve, huh? Okay, any? Mostly out west, huh?
Mostly out west and Midwest, but looks like we're in a growing cadre going north to the northeast, eh? The wave.
Yes.
But I see that you anticipate 250,000 calls a month. I mean, is that right?
By experience with other states and our population, of course, yes.
Well, this is already information we track and know.
Yes.
Just a matter of making it more accessible to the citizens and the travelers.
Yes, that's right. Okay.
No, I'm glad.
God bless
the
travelers.
Thank
I'm glad you.
You
did too. Treasurer, yeah. Already moved to
Treasury. I already did. I wish I could vote on it again. Uh-huh.
All right, thank you, gentlemen. Thanks. All right, we are actually still on the Department of Transportation agenda items.
Yes, sir.
Any other matters of concern on Department of Transportation?
Governor.
Mr. Controller.
Item 14M.
Controller, our AG from State Highway Administration will speak that item. Mr. Harris.
Okay. Welcome.
Good morning. My name is Ed Harris. I'm counsel with the Maryland State Highway Administration and Assistant Attorney General.
I see that we're, with this item, we're awarding a $4.8 million contract for a term of just under 5 years to a firm called HD Miles for a broad range of property management services at the I-95 rest stops in Howard County. The duties that are listed in the material they provided to me say that they're going to do janitorial services, snow, ice removal, painting, landscaping, electrical systems, et cetera. I guess my question is about the procurement process that preceded this award. According to my notes, this firm that we're giving this contract to wasn't even incorporated until March 24th, 2010, 48 days after the bids were due. According to Comar, business must be a registered corporation, must be in good standing, must be up to date on all of its corporate filing requirements in order to be eligible for state contract awards. How could HD Miles meet these eligibility guidelines when they weren't even incorporated, therefore didn't even legally exist, the time they submitted their bid?
I understand your question, Mr. Controller. The requirement is correct that in order to be eligible for award, in order to execute this contract, the corporation must exist. And State Highway has a practice of, prior to awarding contracts, confirming that existence, and the tax numbers actually put, I believe, on the agenda items that are submitted to the board. In this instance, it's not completely analogous, but similar to situations where we've had a foreign corporation, for example, an out-of-state corporation. Foreign doesn't necessarily mean from another country, it means from another state, who is not registered in the state of Maryland. And so long as they are registered by the time of award, they are eligible for the award. There's case law in Maryland that also supports the fact that a corporation in formation, a corporation working to become incorporated, can make a commitment that would bind the corporation. But I think really the best answer, both from a legal perspective and from a protection of the state perspective, is that the the bid includes a bid bond that really, where the bonding company requires or assures that this corporation will sign the contract, and if they don't, the bond's at risk.
Who signed the bond?
the bond is signed by the bonding company and an attorney is assigned to the bonding company and by the one of the principals that was forming the corporation. I really cannot answer what assurances the bonding company got, because in many instances, you know, for example, in our largest construction projects, for example, like on the ICC, the bids come in the name of joint ventures that don't exist until and unless they get the award. So it's not unusual for an entity to not exist until the contract requires their existence.
And the current maintenance work is done by whom?
Well, currently we're in an interim situation where the work is being performed, I believe, by SHA Forces in some open-ended contracts that we have for in the event that there's an issue that needs to be addressed. But the immediate predecessor contractor was a firm, I believe, known as Abacus, who was also the protester and took this matter to the Board of Contract Appeals regarding the award of this contract.
And so the state highway individuals that are being used now, are they going to be assigned to different responsibilities? Well, how does that work?
The state highway, I'm not sure I know the exact answer, but I do know it's important that we try to resolve this before they need to be doing snow removal. That's what I...
Again, Bob Gay, what we're doing, sir, is we are pulling horses off the road to come into the rest area and maintain it until we get this contract back on board. So we are not displacing any employees when we award this contract.
Excellent. Just on a related issue, might as well stay up there. This, I recently traveled up through Maryland on a trip, and the Maryland House and some of these state, what do they call them, Chesapeake House and other places, they're jammed morning, noon, and night. Why don't we have one in Howard County?
Okay. The reason being was when the federal interstate law was passed, there's a prohibition to have commercialization within the right-of-way. So we are not allowed to have anything other than vending machines in the rest areas.
Yeah, but why can't we have a hospitality center like Chesapeake House or Maryland House?
Those facilities were built with state funds, so they're allowed to do that. They're allowed to have restaurants, and we're not allowed to have that on an interstate that was built with federal funds.
We suspect but are not positive that the federal regulation that precludes commercialization in the rest areas is probably motivated in part by local businesses who prefer the folks get off the road and use this business.
Yeah, I guess.
But it is in federal regulation.
I guess I'm a little slow. The Chesapeake House and the Maryland House are not on Route 95.
They're part of the Maryland Transportation Authority's responsibilities, and that's a toll section of highway.
There are no federal maintenance dollars or construction dollars in that portion of the road.
Well, it sounds to me like we're missing out on a real opportunity, and I hope somebody is, you know, commenting with our Washington representatives, because it's ludicrous. I mean, that's that. If we had a hospitality center in that area, it would be probably the biggest in the entire state.
Well, it is one of the busiest rest areas in the country, and I think there is a move afoot to address that issue, but right now there's a legal prohibition.
And has SHA got any kind of a study for either this site or other sites as far as the commercial potential?
I don't believe we have a formal study. We have worked with the Department of Economic Development, and we are looking at some options. But the prohibition on having these full commercialized rest area has always kind of prohibited us from moving forward also on that. But we have been in discussions with DBA.
Is it a question of how far from the highway? I mean, certainly that you can put signs and get off the highway, right?
It's within the right-of-way is the way the law is described. So outside of the right-of-way, you could have a facility there, yes.
That's one of the things you're looking at.
To tell you the truth, Madam Treasurer, I really don't know. I'd have to check into that. I can.
But I would hope, you know, you're looking sort of creatively. I think the controller is absolutely right.
Yeah. I mean, these places are along with the 511 system we're putting in, we should try to get some flexibility. And I
get the information at 511, yeah. Find out they're not going to be able to move anywhere, and they get off. So they, meaning we.
We'd be happy.
Anyway,
I'm
curious
at
about this.
Yes,
I think
sir.
There's commercial potential. Understand the small businesses in the area, but you know, this is different. This is a tremendous opportunity, and we ought to try to get an exemption, if nothing else, from the federal prohibition.
And you're correct, sir. The Chesapeake House and the Maryland House just do an incredible volume of business.
Thank you. No, I agree with you. Okay. I'm through. Thank you. I have one other item.
We have a request to speak on this item. Do you want to hear from the gentleman?
Sure.
All right. Is Mr. David Hausner?
Yes.
All right. Okay. Mr. David Hausner is here on behalf of the second low bidder of Advocates Corporation.
Good morning. Governor, Madam Treasurer, Comptroller, as you aptly pointed out, this entity was not formed prior to them submitting a bid. Maryland law requires them to be formed prior to submitting a bid. It's very cut and dry. Comar requires that an affidavit must be input into this bid process. The affidavit contains in it specifically a provision which demands that a corporation that is applying for the bid be registered as either a domestic corporation or foreign corporation, be in good standing under the laws of the state of Maryland. This entity was not. It was not for 2 months after it submitted its bid. The person that submitted this bid affirmed to the State Highway Administration that he was the president of this entity, that he was lawfully entitled to submit this bid. Maryland law also requires that no one can be an officer of a corporation or elected to be an officer of a corporation until the corporation is formed. He had no legal capacity whatsoever to even submit the bid. Now, State Highway Administration kind of defers that and says, well, they were able to get a bond. Okay, they may have been able to get one. I don't know how an entity that doesn't exist can get a bond, but maybe someone sold them a bond. That in and of itself is one requirement. The other minimum requirement is the entity has to exist. This entity did not. The fair competitive bid process is anchored on the fact that the minimum requirements to meet the obligations to be of a bid are that you meet all the minimum requirements, not just one. This one is fundamental to the process. The affidavit is very clear. It says within the bid itself that the affidavit is an essential part of the bid. There's a provision that specifically states that all corporations must fill out the corporation certificate stating that they're in good standing, stated that they're recognized by the state of Maryland. This is not something that the SHA has discretion to move around or say that that's one of the policies that they sometimes don't look at. The law is very clear. The entity must exist. It didn't. You cannot award the contract to this company. Thank you very much.
No, Governor, I agree with you. I'm going to vote against this. I think that our procurement COMAR regulations should have teeth.
Absolutely.
They don't have teeth. You know, what's the point?
Yes.
Every time someone like this is in direct violation, we just go ahead and invent something at the end that justifies it. I just think it's unacceptable.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
I don't want to invent something at the end that justifies something retrospectively. I don't understand. Our attorney is the Attorney General. With all due respect to your firm, I don't understand. This gentleman made quite a clear presentation, and yet you, the Attorney General, say otherwise.
Well, the analogy that I was using before is the same as, and the Board of Contract Appeals has addressed this issue with a foreign corporation, an out-of-state corporation. The affidavit requires that they be registered in accordance with the corporation article, in accordance with Maryland law. And the Board of Contract Appeals has ruled that that is a matter of bidder responsibility that must be resolved before a contract is awarded. And that's why SHA looks at the corporate registration issue before we sign a contract. We've gotten bids, for example, on projects as large as the Wilson Bridge from joint ventures that don't exist, but they promise to exist before they sign the contract. And their bond would be, in fact, be at risk if they did not fulfill that promise. So,
could I interrupt because the treasurer asked a good question? So did this company exist? But it had not, it existed in some other state? Foreign company?
No.
It's an analogy, but it is not exactly the same. Not a very good analogy, frankly, if we're going to have any integrity and teeth in these regulations. I'm stunned that you would come back and give this a good housekeeping seal of approval, and I don't know whether I'm going to be supported, but you're absolutely right. And I've never seen you before in my life, so thank you for being down here.
So tell me again, does Comar say that, Comar says what? Comar says they have to be...
The affidavit says they must be registered in accordance with the corporations article. This is a corporation that until it received this contract had no other purpose for existence. So their existence requires, if they get the contract, they need to exist in order to sign the contract. So the analogy that I'm using is, for example, the large joint ventures that bid on the Wilson Bridge contract. That joint venture did not exist and never would exist if they were not awarded the contract. And before award, we assure that the joint venture is in good standing. But at the time of bid, the individuals or corporations that sign that contract are committing, and the bond is committing, that that legal entity will exist and sign the contract. And I understand the controller's frustration, but the fact is that the Board of Contract Appeals has determined that this is a matter of bidder responsibility, which must be resolved before the contract is awarded.
When is award?
The award would come upon your approval of... this contract.
So they satisfy the Comar requirements if they're incorporated before we approve this?
In fact, they were incorporated before the issue was ever raised, but they were not incorporated at the time they signed the bid.
Okay, but it doesn't say you have to be incorporated to sign a bid. It says you have to be incorporated to sign the award.
I understand Mr. Hausner's reading and the controller's reading, but what it says is they must be registered in accordance with the laws of the state of Maryland, and until they have this contract, the laws of the state of Maryland don't really require that they exist. They exist if they're doing business in the state. So I know the foreign corporation is a frustrating example, but a corporation may not do any business in the state and may not have any need to register in the state until and unless they're awarded the contract.
But the operative term, the award, I mean, the definition of award is when we vote on this at the Board of Public Works.
That would precede the execution of the contract. That would be approving the award of the contract, I believe, yes.
Okay. So I'm just trying, it seems like the operative language is, and are they incorporated now?
They are incorporated now, and if they refuse to incorporate and refuse to sign the contract, their bid bond would be at risk.
Okay.
The same as any other entity that would refuse to commit to the promises they made in the bid.
Right. And so now they are incorporated, and once we award this, they'll remain incorporated. And your advice is
that under Maryland law, a corporation in formation can make a commitment that can bind the future corporation.
And that's the Comar requirement.
It does, and it creates a risk, though, that the individuals would have to be held personally liable for the corporation's promise, but the bond protects us from that risk. Just as it does in any other setting when you don't know if the corporation has assets to satisfy the promise. So the bond is there to protect us.
I could just, not to beat a dead horse, but your analogies are for existing companies that are doing business that elsewhere who bid and want to get, I can understand that. But for a company that didn't exist to bid on a Maryland contract, that's got to fail just a fairness test for all the other competitors that are incorporated and meet the Comar regulation. I understand the analogy you brought up, but I find it hard to believe that the Board of Contract Appeals okays this stuff because it's unfair.
And sir, I am not at all trying to discount the concern that you're raising, but when this issue was first raised, which was after the corporation existed, we did a little process review at State Highway to make certain that we were complying with what was required to present a legal contract to the board. and we check corporate registration status before we bring the matter to you. At the latest possible date, if we checked it at bid opening, I'm not sure that there would be a legal thing. I believe if we rejected this bid that there might be a claim on the on behalf of the bidder that we were not that we couldn't reject the bid. Now, the Board of Contract Appeals hasn't heard that case, and I don't know what the result of that would be. But once they've said this is a matter of responsibility, and now that they exist, it's hard to imagine how legally we could pull the contract from them.
Amazing what two votes can do.
Sure, go ahead.
I'm okay with that. The fact of the matter is Maryland law dictates and demands that the entity must exist. The law is very clear. The affidavit cannot be cured later. When you sign an affidavit, the facts in it must be true and correct as of the date you sign that affidavit. That was done on February 1st. The president or so-called president of this entity asserted on that day that this entity existed, that it was a Maryland corporation, that it was formed in February of 2010, that it existed under Maryland law, that it was in good standing under Maryland law. None of those things were true. The affidavit, which is required by Maryland law, mandates that that process be in place. It was not. It cannot be cured later. You can't cure it later. This is a $5 million contract. It costs $150 to set up a corporation in Maryland in one day. The entity should have followed Maryland law. It didn't. It should not be demanded, and it should not be awarded this contract.
How about that, Mr. Attorney General? Why would we require an affidavit if the averring to these things if they're
well,
if it's not
necessary probably,
that they're true?
Governor O'Malley, I probably should pull out the affidavit and read it, but it doesn't say all the things that Mr. Hauser just said. It requires that they be registered in accordance with the laws of the state of Maryland.
Could you take your time? Go, if you have the affidavit, could you take a look at it and take your time?
May I say one thing? The bid itself states that the affidavit is an essential part of the bid. It also states that corporations must complete the certification of state registration and tax payments. The person that filled out this bid checked the box that it was a domestic corporation under an affidavit under penalties.
All right, give us a second. Mr. Harris.
Yes.
Okay, take your time, Mr. Harris. Read the thing.
The corporation registered in accordance with the Corporations and Associations Article Annotated Code of Maryland, and that it is in good standing and has filed its annual reports together with its filing fees and so on and so forth. There are often examples. I understand the frustration the corporation didn't exist at all, but there are often examples of, like I said, joint ventures, foreign corporations, who have filed nothing with the state of Maryland, who check that box, and who are legally obligated under the commitment of their bid to do that by the time of award. And that's the basis of the Board of Contract Appeals decisions on these issues that say that corporate status is a matter of bidder responsibility, which as distinguished from a matter of bid responsiveness. In terms of responsiveness, a bid has to be responsive to the four corners of the bid as of the date the bid is submitted. In terms of responsibility, that is a matter that is determined as of the time the contract is awarded and executed. So that as long as that corporation exists, and I understand the frustration with the analogy, and I agree that it is not the same, but I'm going to use an artificial name because I don't recall the name, but Wilson Bridge Constructors, which is the name of a joint venture of three different entities that agree to form that, will never exist until and unless they are awarded that contract. So in accordance with the corporations article, there's no need for that for that joint venture or this corporation to exist until and unless they receive the award of this contract.
But those individual corporations did exist even if they had not entered into a joint venture.
There's a decision from one of the from the Comptroller General, which hears these kinds of issues on the federal level, who heard a very analogous case, and what they concluded was that a bid submitted in a corporate name may be accepted even though the firm became incorporated after bid opening, since the firm was, they use the phrase, a de facto corporation, and under applicable state law would be a stop from denying its corporate existence and award to the bidder would not involve substitution of a bidding entity. So the point of that is that a de facto corporation, a corporation in formation, can make a promise that the individuals could be held to if they don't comply. But here we don't have that difficulty because we have a bid bond. So we don't have to pierce, if you will, the corporate veil and get to the individual of the bidder. If this bid was not executed as required by the commitment in the bid, the bond would be at risk. And I can't say what assurances the bonding company got, but I would suspect that the individuals were on the hook to the bonding company.
Can I just ask, don't you feel a little awkward about awarding a $5 million contract to someone who lied in an affidavit under oath?
I think that, I know you're not comfortable with the analogy, but I think that when a foreign corporation checks that box and says they're registered in the state of Maryland and have done all these things, they're essentially saying, if that's required under Maryland law, I've done it, in accordance with the corporations and associations. And until they get the contract, there was no legal requirement for them to do that.
What's the harm in rebidding this? I mean, can you do an extension of the current maintenance contract?
Well, the protester was the current contract. That contract's been terminated, and the and state forces are doing this work. And we would have to survive a legal challenge to rejecting the bid.
And from a practical perspective, I mean, the game has changed, if you will. At this point, if we rebid it, the entity in question is in fact now incorporated, and therefore that particular impediment to the whole process would have eliminated itself. And as it stands right now, the proposed award entity is close to $500,000 below the next lowest bidder.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe that there are the decisions of the Board of Contract Appeals relating to foreign corporations support the proposition that this gentleman did not lie on the affidavit.
For 2 weeks so we can actually look at these materials ourselves. And the board does have a counsel in addition to the Office of Attorney General. The Board of Public Works does. I think it would be good.
That's fine with us, Madam Treasurer.
Okay.
I mean, the Attorney General is our state's attorney.
We have communicated with your counsel and raised some of these points, and we'd be happy to discuss that further.
Well, we could defer for 2 weeks and make sure everybody's comfortable with the decision.
I understand that the disgruntled bidder is the former holder of the contract, and so the longer you prolong changing it,
they're not still doing the work anyway, right?
I believe we're doing it with state forces now.
With all due respect to Backus, we're frustrated by the concept that a protest that their own protest could extend their contract. And so we found another way of addressing the services while this legal issue was being pursued.
Like the Board's General Counsel and the Procurement Advisor to get back in 2 weeks at the next meeting. Okay, and Mr. Harris had talked with Mr. Bedward and Mr. Hausner. You can meet Mr. Bedward on the way out and talk in the next few weeks.
Sure.
John was making analogies to foreign entities. Foreign entities exist. Now, I still don't think a foreign entity that is not in compliance with Maryland law would meet the form of the affidavit. I'm sorry?
I think that's what we're asking our attorney to
Well, but let's read the very specific language in the affidavit. It's very clear. I further affirm that the business named above is a domestic corporation. February 1, 2010.
Right. Sir, you're a very strong advocate for your client, but we want to hear from our attorneys, not from your client's attorney.
I understand, but I think the affidavit needs to be understood. The governor asked for the affidavit for that to be read. The other thing that I think is very important is that the gentleman said that you can pierce the corporate veil. You can't pierce the corporate veil.
You're not helping your client as far as I'm concerned,
we'll
sir.
We'll talk in the next 2 weeks.
Okay. Well, let's appreciate the attorneys being here. And we'll have the Board of Public Works attorney and the Attorney General's office confer and get us some more definitive word on this. And if, for me, the operative language seems to come down to the point at which the contract is awarded. But, so, all right.
Yes, sir.
So Treasurer moves that we defer for 2 weeks. Seconded, I assume, by Comptroller. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed, nay. The ayes have it. We move on now to the balance of the Department of Transportation agenda items.
I have a question on item 27.
Item 27.
Is there someone here that can answer some questions about this project?
Yes, sir.
We deferred this, I guess, at the last meeting. What did you come up with?
I'll be happy to respond to any questions you have, but also joining us today is the Deputy Administrator for Planning and Engineering from the Mass Transit Administration, Henry Kay.
Oh, good. Mr. Kay.
Good morning.
Nice to see you. Well, I'll just, I guess, comment that this was deferred at your request last time. This is a tough issue for me because I support, frankly, all three of the transit projects. But we're talking about a $160 million commitment over 8 years. And, you know, much as I support, frankly, the Purple Line in half of 20 years, and Governor, I appreciate your administration's support of these mass transit projects. It just strikes me that an 8-year, $160 million commitment is an awful lot of money for an awful long time for, frankly, projects that are still speculative is probably too harsh a word, but the question of whether they're going to get funded is up in the air. So I would like to make sure that because there are a lot of things that have been cut that really are vital, that you believe these consulting services are absolutely vital to the goal of getting these projects funded and built. And number two, that we're actually going to get $160 million worth of work out of this labyrinth of consultants that is before us in the work group. So, Mr. Kay, maybe you could give us an overview of what these folks are doing and why it's crucial to have such a long-term relationship. Some of these companies, are they even going to exist 8 years from now?
Yes, certainly. Good morning, Mr. Comptroller. Thank you. For the record, my name is Henry Kay. I'm the Deputy Administrator for Planning and Engineering at MTA, Governor, Madam Treasurer. Mr. Comptroller, thank you for those questions. I mean, the contracts in question will support work for the Red Line, the Purple Line, two major rapid rail projects that we're planning in the Baltimore and Washington regions. They're also constructed, the contracts are constructed in a way that we would also be able to do other transit planning and engineering work under them should, you know, the need arise or the Red and Purple Lines not proceed, you know, given the schedules that we've identified. I mean, these are quite complex projects. We expect they will take many years to develop as, you know, is typically the case for transportation projects. You know, examples we can think of, the ICC, the Woodrow Wilson Bridge, are usually many years in the planning and engineering process before they even go to construction. What we need is, you know, a team of consultants available to support us during that process so that we have the kind of consistency and continuity and project knowledge that it takes to have to make sure we can control the project resources, have very tight controls over quality and continuity, and get to the point where we're taking them for construction. Right now, if you look at what we have budgeted for just the Red Line and Purple Line, let alone any other MTA planning and engineering work, there's nearly $500 million in our six-year program. So we have actually far more budgeted than we can actually cover in these particular contracts. So at this point, we are planning to do $160 million worth of work and actually far in excess of that, you know, even in the next 6 years, let alone the next 8 years. Now, to get to your question about, you know, whether it's really likely we will, these projects will proceed and we'll do this work, it's an absolutely valid question. What we are doing now is going through a process to make these projects eligible for the federal funds that are so critical for them to proceed. I mean, generally, we are assuming that these will be 50% funded by the federal government. We need to make sure that we are meeting every federal requirement, dotting every date, every I, crossing every T, so that we are competitive when we go into that process. Part of that competitiveness means having the resources available to design and deliver these projects. And so it's critical for us that we do this work now to make ourselves eligible. Now, should we, you know, the sort of unfortunate circumstance exists where we're not competitive in that process, we don't get the federal funds that we're anticipating, then we would simply not do this work. And we would these contract resources would either not be used at all or they would be used for other MTA projects. So we're not making a commitment to spend money that we don't have, I mean, to sort of get to your bottom line.
Well, that's a good answer. And what is the current timetable for funding, construction, and completion of the Purple Line and the Red Line?
These are the Purple Line and Red Line are on nearly identical schedules at this point. We are right now making a request to the federal government to enter what they call the preliminary engineering phase. That is federal terminology that doesn't quite line up with the way we think of it at the state level. It's essentially the end of the planning process and the beginning of the engineering process. We expect to get federal approval to enter that phase early next year. That PE is about, preliminary engineering is about a two-year process, after which we have to get approval again to enter final design, and then we go to construction. So within the next 4 years, you know, we'll be going through two steps of approval by the federal government. Each of those has funds that accompany it before we go to construction. So it's during that time that we are, you know, going through this process of getting these federal funds. To answer your question about schedule, at this point, for both projects, we're expecting to begin construction in 2016 and have these projects open to service in 2019.
Okay. And I mentioned the labyrinth of consultants. That may be too harsh for you guys, but are you convinced that these folks are not going to be regulating their own sub-entities and somehow you've got all this Byzantine...
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, there are, I mean, you accurately point out there are dozens, I mean, we have joint ventures here and they have dozens of, between them, dozens of sub-consultants that do all the kinds of specialized work that we need to have available to us as we go through this process. We appreciate the question that was raised before. We have since spent many hours with these joint ventures and their subs. We have reallocated sub-consultants to absolutely assure that no company will be supervising its own work, you know, between one contract and another, so that we create that accountability. We also committed to retain an officer, a project control officer, who will specifically be tasked with monitoring that. We absolutely appreciate the point. We don't want one firm to be monitoring, you know, the work of itself under another contract.
Okay, Mr. Controller, that's between the two entities, the project management consultant and the general engineering consultant. You know, great care was taken to make sure that neither entity would, or that the management consultant would not be overseeing their own work.
Good. Well, I have a lot of confidence personally, Mr. Tay, because I've worked with you many years, so that's reassuring to have you come down and comment. On a separate item, Mr. Secretary, I've got a question about the subject that Mayor Purnell brought up, the highway user revenues. There's no doubt, because I drive around a lot, that we have just an epidemic of potholes. And I'm very concerned about these highway user revenue dollars because in balancing the state budget, everyone in their wisdom decided to cut that significant amount of money. And it's causing a lot of problems. And I'm wondering what the timetable is and what your thoughts are about restoring some of those dollars, because I'm going to vote for this 8-year, $160 million project. Fine on that, but
if I could interject,
if I could just a minute, Governor. I mean, this is a crushing problem, and I'm not sure why the city councilman got up and made the comment where we shouldn't be putting Purlock and other towns in the position of Faustian choices between education and highway maintenance. This is going to cost us a lot down the road if we don't figure out how to get some money down to these communities. Sorry, Governor.
That's okay. I think that question is better directed to me. We have been facing a lot of I call them tough choices, but Faustian might be an appropriate word as well. I mean, all of these have been tough choices, and in this trade-off, as we balance our budget and move forward at the same time, it's a lot of difficult things that we've had to do. I shared with the Maryland Municipal League that, and also with MACO, that the last things, it should take some solace from the fact that the very last things we cut in the course of this three-year march through the desert of declining revenues will also be the first things we look to restore as our revenues come back. So, Mr. Comptroller, I can assure you that I've heard the complaints of people in the counties and in the towns of Maryland as well, and we are looking at the revenue performance. Excuse me. And if there's some relief we can provide sooner rather than later, we will. But all of that, I say, within the context of pointing out that we are also, you know, constructing a budget for next year and closing a $1 billion gap there. It's a much smaller gap than it would have been were it not for the additional job creation and the revenue forecast. But I hear you loud and clear. And we are looking at some possibility of doing something. And in the meantime, we are pushing FEMA, and there are some dollars that have been forthcoming for the storm reimbursements that are helping somewhat out there. But I am focused on this, Mr. Comptroller, and hopefully we can find a way to ease the pain out there a little bit on this score.
Right. And I didn't, you know, you have the cards, Governor, as far as helping a little bit here, but it's not your fault. You know, we cut some of this at the Board of Public Works, but others then memorialized it and made it an annual thing. Problem is, it's one of those expenditures that is incredibly cost-effective. And frankly, I hope, you know, the governor has tried to manage through a lot of problem areas, but I certainly hope you can look in your budget and we don't have to do this out of a fund balance or something, but we can figure out some way to provide some relief because there's a long winter possibly coming up. And, you know, we need to get some relief down there. But thank you, Governor.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Anything else on transportation? Hearing none, Comptroller moves approval, seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signify by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. And that concludes our agenda. Thanks very much. I'm sorry. Oh, I apologize. Hold on. That does not conclude our agenda. Not that I forget.
I'm done.
Yeah, no.
You're my favorite. You're my favorite secretary.
You move approval of my item.
Tied for first place. No, don't tell the others.
Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller.
We have one more item. I apologize. Hold your horses. Department of General Services.
Today we have 33 items on our agenda, including one supplemental. We revised items 8, 12, 14. I withdraw an item E on 5GM. I'll be glad to answer any questions you have at this time.
Anything on Department of General Services, Madam Treasurer? Treasurer moves approval, seconded by the Comptroller. All in favor, signal by saying aye. All opposed, nay. The ayes have it, and that concludes our
Thank you.